Hello, I'm David Tennant. Welcome to a very special programme here on Radio 2. For the past 4 years now, I have played the Doctor in BBC One's drama series Doctor Who. It's been an incredible journey. It's been unforgettable and quite life-changing. And someone who has been with me on this remarkable adventure through time and space and Cardiff has been the writer, executive producer and showrunner, Mr. Russell T. Davis. In a moment, I'll be talking to Russell about all things Doctor Who, and I'll be asking the man, once dubbed by the Independent newspaper as television's saviour of Saturday night drama, what happens next? Stay tuned. Welcome, everyone, to Who on Who.
I'm the Doctor. I'm a Time Lord. I'm from the planet Gallifrey in the constellation of Castorberus. I'm 903 years old, and I'm the man who's going to save your lives and all 6 billion people on the planet below. You got a problem with that?
No.
In that case...
Allons-y! Hostile elements will be deleted.
Hello, Sarah Jane.
It's you, Doctor. Oh my God, it's you, isn't it?
I am my mummy.
Go ahead, Doctor. Impress me.
It is customary, I think, to have an imaginary friend only during one's childhood. You are to be congratulated on your persistence.
Scopo, tro, no, fro, jo, co, fo, to, do.
No, bo, ho, so, ko, ro, to, so. Bokotozuko, ba, popo, jo.
I'm nothing special. I'm a temp. I'm not even that. I'm nothing.
Donna Noble, you're the most important woman in the whole of creation.
Master K-9!
No need to ask who you are.
Famous Martha Jones. How long since you were last in Britain?
365 days. It's been a long year.
Are you hurt?
Are you hurt?
You don't have to talk.
You don't have to talk.
I'm trying to help.
I'm trying to help.
My name's the Doctor.
My name's the Doctor.
Okay, can you stop?
Okay, can you stop?
I'd like you to stop.
I'd like you to stop.
Don't blink. Don't even blink. Blink and you're dead.
Like you said, Doctor, responsibility.
Defending the Earth. Can't argue with that.
Time Lords are the stuff of legend.
Who's she?
Rose, Sarah Jane. Sarah Jane, Rose.
You can tell you're getting older. Your assistants are getting younger.
I'm not his assistant.
No. I get you, Tiger.
You will be exterminated! Exterminate! Exterminate!
Enough of words. Let's begin.
Here we go! Good luck, Doctor!
Will somebody tell me what's going on?
When he's dying, his body, it repairs itself. It changes.
I'm regenerated.
Every single one of these people knew your name. Now they've all forgotten you.
Good.
Trust me, we need the Doctor.
Sun is shining in the sky. There ain't a cloud in sight. It stopped raining. Everybody's in the lake. And don't you know, it's a beautiful day. Hey.
That was Mr. Blue Sky by ELO. As featured in the Doctor Who episode Love and Monsters, of course. There will be lots of songs with a tenuous Doctor Who link being played throughout this programme. You're going to have to guess what's coming next, Russell. Scattered through that, little clips and tasters of the Doctor's journeys over the last few years. The man who has penned many of those is Mr. Russell T. Davis, who is sitting opposite me now. Hello.
Hello, Mr. David Tennant.
How are you doing?
How nice to be here in your home.
Yes. Sit by my crackling fire and let me quiz you about your life and work.
It's like a normal conversation for us, really,
it is.
Isn't it?
This is what we do, and I'm going to be asking the questions to which I don't know any of the answers.
What I like is the fact...
I like the fact that you've not turned your phone off.
No, I'm
look
sorry.
At that.
That's be someone. I'm this sorry.
Is, who's that?
That'll be someone listening and commenting on how marvellous we are. I like the fact that the last person you interviewed on Radio 2 was Kylie Minogue. Fine company that puts me in.
Yes.
In fact, that makes me the next Kylie. Literally.
You are, indeed, you're sitting in the same seat.
Thank
it's
you.
Still warm from her little pert Australian bum.
Moving on.
Yes. By the time the listeners hear this, we will be only a couple of days away from the very final Doctor Who episode that we were both involved in.
The bitter end.
The bitter, bitter
That's
end.
That's what I wanted
the
to call
glorious
it.
Finale.
Imagine an episode called The Bitter End. All carried out screaming.
So how are you feeling as you stare that in the face?
Excited. Literally, I love this time of year. I love a Doctor Who Christmas. The fact that we are plastered everywhere is deliberate. I don't mean we're personally plastered. I mean that Doctor Who is everywhere.
Yes.
It's a wonderful thing. And this final episode is so exciting. You've seen the Time Lords returning and they're evil and led by Timothy Dalton. And what could be more exciting than that, frankly?
Yes. Yes, it is very exciting, isn't it?
Oh, I literally, you make these things, I can't wait for people to see them. I'm literally, yeah. And I do sit and watch them. You watch them on transmission, don't you?
If I possibly can, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Most of the time I do, yeah.
Yes.
When did you decide that this would be your last one?
Well, we both get asked that, don't we? And it's hard. It should keep a diary.
It's not like there was one day, is it?
No, it's not like you wake up one day, you're thinking all the time how much further keep going. I remember we had a very big conversation before the start of The Runaway Bride. We went out for dinner and
we did. Yeah.
Yeah, in Cardiff Bay. Yeah. And again, you don't pin anything down. You go, right, I'm leaving on this exact date. You just sort of think, how much more should we do? And we were coming up with the notion of a gap year at the same time and that we could come back and do specials. But again, that meal wasn't that concrete. Julie Gardner was there. It just sort of coalesces, doesn't it? And then, so with hindsight, you look back and go, oh, we've decided. But it was always fluid, and you were still in a state of flux about it yourself.
Oh, right up until relatively recently, absolutely. Yeah. Right. You know, I was kept hedging my bets.
No further offers coming in.
Yeah, exactly.
Pay off the rent on the flat.
But yeah, it sort of evolved, didn't it? And we did kind of do it slightly hand in hand, I think.
With Julie Gardner as well. Fellow executive. And Phil Collinson, the producer, had already left. He left a year early just because we'd worn him out, I think.
Yes.
Like a used rag.
He ran screaming for the hills.
So it just made sense, and it's continued to make sense with hindsight, really. What I'm pleased about is there's not been one moment where I've gone, oh my God, we've done the wrong thing. Absolutely never. And that's great, because I thought I might do.
Me too. But it feels like we've had the right amount of time to tell a great story.
Yes. It's still hard to know how it'll feel next week.
Yes.
Well, it's done. This is all hypothetical still. It's that we might be sitting there weeping, gutted, dismayed. I don't think so, but it could strike us in all sorts of ways. You just don't know. Because it's still valid now. It's still viable.
Well, it's still ours.
Yeah, exactly.
But at least we're handing it over in rude health.
Hopefully. Oh, very rude is the word for Stephen Moffat. Very, very rude health. So, yeah. Oh, I'm not worried about that. I'm not worried about the programme.
Yeah.
Never mind that. What about me? What's this interview about?
If you left, would you consider writing for the show again?
I've not. I've said, bless Stephen, he did ask me through gritted teeth.
Stephen Moffat, by the way, is the new executive producer and head writer on Doctor Who.
He's the new me. I'm the new Kylie. He's the new me. It's
absolutely.
Great showbiz shuffling going on. He's brilliant, wonderful. He's written so many episodes like Blink and The Empty Child and The Girl in the Fireplace with Madame de Pompadour. He's just a genius. So he did ask me, but actually for a start, I've done 60 episodes. You know, and plus,
have you really?
Yeah, I know. 60 Doctor Who's plus all the Torchwoods, plus all the Sarah Janes. There's only so many ways to conquer the world. And I didn't want to sort of write myself thin. But also, they've got this brand new toy box, that new team. They've got Matt Smith, who's going to be a brilliant new doctor. Well, not bad, David. He'll
be fine.
He'll fill a space. Yeah. But I know he's going to be brilliant.
He's going to be great. And they need us out of the way, really.
Well, who wants to be a ghost hanging over? You wouldn't hover over Matt Smith's shoulder. Although that's a good idea for an episode.
It's not a bad idea, yes.
Yeah.
Might do that. That's the anniversary special, isn't it?
They should do like a Jekyll and Hyde one where, you know, he can't stop changing from one to the other.
Stop, you've finished. You've moved on. Right. Stop coming up with ideas.
I shall be silent.
We're going to play you a clip now. This is from 2005. Listen to this.
Doctor! Stay away!
Doctor, tell me what's going on.
I absorbed all the energy of the time vortex, and no one's meant to do that. Every cell in my body's dying.
How can you do something?
Yeah, I'm doing it now. Time Lords have this little trick. It's sort of a way of cheating death. Except, it means I'm going to change. And I'm not going to see you again. Not like this. Not with this daft old face. And before I go...
Don't say that.
Rose. Before I go, I just want to tell you, you were fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. And you know what? So was I.
And that was when I came on.
Oh, it's good on radio, isn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's quite good, isn't
it? I enjoy this.
That was Christopher Eccleston, obviously, as the Ninth Doctor.
That was...
The last time you wrote a regeneration scene.
Yes.
This will be your second, of course.
They were Chris's last lines. I wonder what your last lines are, David.
I wonder.
Unless we fiddled with it in the edit, we might surprise you. I might have dubbed you.
I might have surprised you. You've been in America. I've been in recording. I put a little speech in.
With Stephen. Yes, he went in there.
Yeah.
You've done a whole little monologue where you sit down
and
say...
I'd like to thank my family.
I'd like to assess my life as a Time Lord. A gentle viewer, let me take you through it.
Yeah.
No, brilliant. They are such good things to write because you sort of know you know, you think of those 8-year-olds watching, and it's history to them. Mm. You know, I remember it myself. You do as well.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
Just a huge mode of telling. It's not, you know, it sounds a bit posh, but it is a sort of television cultural history, and I think that's important.
This time around, I mean, the first time in 2005, that happened at the end of the first series that you did, the first series of Doctor Who back, and it was all... I don't know that people necessarily knew what was coming. They didn't maybe know, and certainly children maybe didn't know that that's how Doctor Who worked.
Yes.
So there was something more of a surprise. This time, of course, because of the way this show is analysed and the way we have to release the information before it gets leaked, people have known this is coming for over a year now, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely, it is. And it was always a shame that that first regeneration was spoiled. It was leaked because it was meant to be. Imagine if that had been a total...
If we'd managed to pull off the coup.
Total surprise, which we did manage with you last year.
Yes.
At the end of the episode.
We'll talk about that. We're going to talk about...
Yeah.
We're going to talk about how things... How our relationship with the press might have evolved.
Absolutely.
Yes. But there's a sort of game in this as well, isn't there? That you're kind of writing a story that the audience are all expecting.
Yes, that it is the fact that everyone knows what's going to happen and yet they don't know how it happens or why.
Is it challenging or is it just liberating to be able to write that flavour in?
It's challenging in the sense that, oh, gosh, you don't want to let people down with that.
Yeah.
And I mean kids especially.
Yeah.
It's like there'll be adults who'll nitpick and adults who'll sit and laugh and enjoy the whole thing. I don't mean they'll laugh at you, David. I just mean they'll laugh with joy. Yes. It's always been one of the greatest engines ever on working on Doctor Who to keep it good and to keep the quality up is children watching. And that, you know, when we watch an episode of a show we don't... Say you've got a show you love and you watch an episode that's not quite so good. We shrug it off and hope it'll be good next week.
Yeah.
When a child does that, their whole week is ruined.
Yeah.
And if you get a bad episode or something, the day is rubbish and you're dismayed and there's a real cloud over you. So that's a great engine on Doctor Who to sort of say, keep the quality up all the time.
How tense did you feel then about getting it right, this finale?
I mean, you've got to write.
Did you just know you'd be able to because the stakes are so high and it just...
I sort of always knew how it would happen. I always knew about the four knocks.
Right.
And why. You know, in a way, it's oh, the whole setup, the how and the why and the where of it. It takes a long time to get a script to the right point, but I always knew we'd get there. And even then, details were clicking into place. It's never completely pre-planned on a piece of paper or something.
No.
In fact, until I write the script, I don't write any sort of treatments or synopses anywhere. So if I'd been run over by a bus, you'd be going through a very different story now.
Yes.
So it's just, I just love it. And having seen, obviously I've seen the finished version, and I could not be happier.
We've got a clip from it now. A little exclusive clip.
Have you?
From the end of time. Listen to this.
Tell me. Where's your TARDIS?
You could be so wonderful.
Where is it?
You're a genius. You're stone cold brilliant. You are, I swear, you really are. But you could be so much more. You could be beautiful. With a mind like that, we could travel the stars. It would be my honour. Because you don't need to own the universe. Just see it. To have the privilege of seeing the whole of time and space. That's ownership enough.
Would it stop then? Noise in my head.
I can help.
Don't know what I'd be without that noise.
I wonder what I'd be without you.
Yeah.
Yes, very exciting. From the final part two of The End of Time. Baby, baby, baby. You are my voodoo child, my voodoo child.
Rogue Traders Voodoo Child
from
The Sound of Drums.
Oh yeah, all the music today has a Doctor Who link. You only put established tracks in very rarely, don't you?
Very rarely, but with that one, I actually got the title of The Sound of Drums from that track. Here It Comes, The Sound of Drums. And
right,
because I love that track, actually, and that it's a ferocious song. That, and the master plays that song while he's decimating the earth. And it's so savage and mad, and it shows how insane he is that he's dancing, his wife is dancing to pop music while people people being murdered. So that song wrote itself into it. I wanted that song.
Yeah. If you've just tuned in, that might not have made much sense. I'm David Tennant, and I'm here on Radio 2 talking to Russell T Davies about the last few years on Doctor Who.
The end of time.
Our final episode will screen in just a couple of days' time.
It's on its way. Nothing can stop it.
It's coming.
If we changed our minds now, the BBC would run in and re-edit and say...
A quick reshoot?
Yeah.
No, apparently the next guys are quite good as well.
Yeah.
Let's say it. We've got to... It's not often that a writer is as well recognised as yourself, probably.
That was my big mistake. I think. Why is that? I don't know.
Your big mistake was not accepting the offer to go on Dancing on Ice. That.
Which is true. I was actually.
Yes.
Well, what else I was asked to be on that? It was when it was very first created. It was called Stars on Thin Ice, and they contacted every Z-list celebrity in the world.
No, don't and I call was yourself on Z-list.
I was on someone's list somewhere. I'd have been good. Can you imagine me?
In a spangly jumpsuit.
Absolutely.
It would have been splendid.
I would have upstaged Barrowman, and that takes
a lot
of doing.
Was it the same series that John was on?
I think he took my place.
He probably got, they went to him after you.
Should we tell him he was second choice?
We should definitely tell him that. Yeah, although you don't want to crush John's fragile ego. Now, you're one of a huge team. Who are the unsung heroes?
Oh, that's hard. I mean, the unsung heroes are everyone who works in it. It's those riggers who are carrying planks at 3 in the morning in a rainy field. There are jobs people don't even know exist. There's Cerise, who sits upstairs as our post-production supervisor, whose job is to coordinate all the layers that you need for the special effects shots and to get them to London and to get them to angry editors and directors who are late and behind schedule and keep them happy. And Cerise Doyle, her name is, she doesn't get a page devoted to her in Doctor Who magazine. And she's absolutely wonderful. Our editors never get praised, actually. The people who sit there and actually edit the pictures. People talk to directors and they talk to us a lot as producers. The editors sit there honing and buffing your every blink and reaction and finding the best take of every line, which is hard sometimes with you, David.
It's hours of footage. It is an incredible crew down there in Cardiff, isn't it? Most of whom are still working on the show now.
Yeah, lucky Matt Smith and everyone, they'll inherit that team. And you hear those television interviews, don't you, where people go, it's like one happy family. And most of the time they're all gouging each other's eyes out.
Yes.
And it really is happy as Larry down there. It's something about Doctor Who, I think. It's a Cardiff thing. It's good people working there. You're not in London. I think that helps.
Yeah, it doesn't take
atmosphere.
You 2 hours to get to work in the morning.
But it's Doctor Who. I think it's because kids are watching. It's that, there's old Hutcho on the crew and his kids are watching.
Yeah.
And it's part of the game of it. And it's loved more by the people working on it because of the children. So it's a brilliant system.
Mm. Now, you and I are often asked to list our favourite episode monster, and it's impossible, isn't it?
I hate that.
We never really answer the question whenever we're asked. I think clearly the producer of this programme, knowing that in advance, has chosen his own favourite bits.
Oh.
So we're going to play some bits.
Yeah.
And apparently these are your best bits. This is it.
Thank
this
you.
Has been defined by...
Malcolm Prince. Hooray.
Yes, by Malcolm Prince, our producer.
Prince among men.
The first one... This can't be right. I'm not even in the first one. It can't be that
what?
Good. Let's hear it.
If this message is activated, then it can only mean one thing. We must be in danger, and I mean fatal. I'm dead or about to die any second with no chance of escape.
No!
And that's okay. Hope it's a good death. But I promise to look after you, and that's what I'm doing. The TARDIS is taking you home.
I won't let you.
And I bet you're fussing and moaning now. Typical. But hold on and just listen a bit more. The TARDIS can never return for me. Emergency Program 1 means I'm facing an enemy that should never get their hands on this machine. So this is what you should do. Let the TARDIS die. Just let this old box gather dust. No one can open it, no one will even notice it. Let it become a strange little thing standing on a street corner. And over the years, the world will move on and the box will be buried. And if you want to remember me, then you can do one thing. That's all. One thing.
Have a good life. Do that for me, Rose. Have a fantastic life.
It was a holographic Christopher Eccleston being magnificent
word.
And bringing the nation to tears.
That's the parting of the ways.
Yes. And the relationship with the Doctor and Rose, which was so central to the first 2 years of the show, well, really, it's gone right the way through.
Right? Yes, with every companion. Yeah.
It's often said that that kind of emotional life is something you brought to the show where it wasn't quite at the forefront back in the day, was it?
No, it wasn't. And it wasn't the place for it to be back in the day.
Yeah.
Literally the whole of television has evolved. It's like in the 60s, people were genuinely happy to watch things like Man in a Suitcase, where people just ran around streets shooting it. And television grows and it becomes more emotional. I still find it strange. that it's a really peculiarly science fiction thing that you have to sit here and talk about how much emotion there is in a drama.
Mm.
It's only science fiction where it's even remotely possible that there isn't emotion in a drama. And actually, even that isn't true anymore. That's true of old science fiction. Even your Star Trek Next Generation, Buffy, things like that paved the way. It's just not good enough to write science fiction as cold and emotionless anymore. And plus, I didn't actually come from a science fiction background. Although I love Doctor Who, I'd spent years writing drama for Channel 4, for ITV, for BBC. So I just carried on writing it as a drama, really. I didn't shift. I just wrote it as I would write it. So it's not like I invented anything.
But it's not just Doctor Who that you've ended up writing down in Cardiff, isn't it? Because you rebooted Doctor Who, and then from that came another two shows.
Yeah. The whole thing came about because we were just ambitious and hungry. And as we were talking about the great crews down there and stuff like that, there's no point in them having just 9 months' work out of Doctor Who. Mm. Julie Gardner, the executive producer, and myself wanted an empire, frankly.
Maybe you should start with Torchwood then, because that was the first one, wasn't it?
Yes, that came along first, and it was simply, you know, let's face it, we were Flavour of the Month at the BBC. Actually, we've been Flavour of the past 5 years at the BBC. And you make hay while the sun shines. It's very interesting if you look at now, if you try to get Torchwood off the ground now, with money being this tight, with the licence fee under threat, I don't think you get Torchwood even commissioned now.
Do you think you get Doctor Who commissioned now?
I think it's a big enough title. Right. I think it's whether you get this budget now, I don't know. But you probably would do. It's like it's an extraordinary property, Doctor Who, and there are people now in charge of the BBC who recognise that it's like Sherlock Holmes, it's like Tarzan, it's like Merlin, it's an iconic figure. I would guess the Doctor Who's future is very, very safe, in as much as anything at the BBC is very, very safe with the licence fee under threat. Yeah. But we just wanted to make more shows, have more output, and we had adult ideas that simply would never fit into Doctor Who. And Torchwood was an idea that had been ticking away at the back of my head as a separate series anyway. I just sort of thought Psychic Cops it was in my head or something.
Right.
Just, you know, that sort of format you dream up now and again. It was all at the right time. It was serendipities. There was John Barrowman, who was leaving Doctor Who temporarily, we thought at the time, because you were coming in, and I thought the Doctor didn't need a space buccaneer at his side. So everything just fitted into that place. And lo and behold, there was Torchwood, which is more work for more people.
And then Sarah Jane after that.
Yes, that came about because the phenomenal children's audience for Doctor Who. And again, it was an appetite for more. And they actually, the children's department came to us. What was nice is they came to us as a drama department at BBC Wales, saying we want something made by BBC Wales.
Oh, okay.
By your crews and by your people, not just from me, but, like, you know, your great people. Let's work together.
Right.
And that's when the whole thing's paying off. That's when the BBC system, the in-house system, is magnificent and bears fruit, because it was comparatively easy to get that off the ground. They wanted a young Doctor Who. I said, absolutely not.
What was the notion? Well, it would literally be Doctor Who in the young years.
Like Harry Potter in the Time Lord Academy sort of thing.
I see.
It would have been you, basically,
but
played by a young boy.
I could have done it.
Yes, from a distance.
A little bit, yeah, exactly. If you just put me in soft focus,
pull the camera back.
Yeah.
But imagine how dreadful that would have been. Actually, I was like, no way are you doing that, because all mystery and majesty of the Time Lords would have just disappeared into high school pranks at the Academy. But I instantly sort of said, we just had Liz Sladen had just come back into Doctor Who for a one-off story. And it was, again, just all these pieces in the right place. And I just went, well, if you take her, I can give her a sort of action-adventure Doctor Who-type series on Earth. Ba-bom, there we are now into its fourth year commissioned and fifth year, hopefully.
Yeah.
Running and running.
And you come from a background in children's television, don't you?
Yeah, I started my very first job.
You have a passion for it.
I do. I think it's vital and important and underfunded these days. My very first job in telly was on a kid's show called Why Don't You?
Yes.
Switch off your television set and go out and do something less boring instead.
Yes.
Which was lovely, joyous. That was actually presented by kids and made by kids. What a laugh to work on that was.
You talked about it a bit, but do you think the TV world is very different now than it was when Doctor Who was commissioned 5 years ago?
That's hard, I think. Well, it's always hard, isn't it? I think you can go from decade to decade and there's people saying it's all rubbish now and everything's gone downhill and there's not enough money. Mm. And, you know, people have always said that to me and I've always been lucky and got things made. It's like, you know, I did a drama called The Second Coming with Chris Eccleston. People said, you'll never get that made, because that was about the return to Earth, the Son of God. And it was made by ITV. It was made by the big commercial station, by the last station you would ever think would make something that was that strong meat. So in terms of a writer and a producer, it's, I always think good ideas will always get through. There will be hurdles and obstacles, but so there should be when you're spending millions of pounds of people's money. And, you know, it shouldn't be easy to get your hands on that much money. But I think the license fee is under a greater threat now than ever before. I think you can literally see its end now on its way in about, certainly within 10 years.
And that would be catastrophic for television.
I think personally, I mean, talk about people sitting there going, oh, it's not as good as it was in the old days. Mm-hmm. Everyone will be sitting there going, what's happened to our TV? Why haven't we got this? And our radio, why haven't we got this? Why haven't we got that? Mm-hmm. And once gone, no one will ever bring back attacks.
No.
Never. Once gone, it's gone forever. I think it's terrible.
On that note, we have another highlight. 10 points, if you can name where this is from.
Did you never think all those years standing beside me to ask about that watch? Never? Did you never once think, not ever, that you could set me free?
John, I'm sorry. No, John, I'm so sorry.
And you, with your chair and your dough, driving me insane!
Professor,
that is not my name! The professor was an invention. So perfect a disguise that I forgot who I am.
John, then who are you?
I am the master.
Derek Jacobi as Professor Yana, well, as the Master, and Chipu Chung Achantho from the episode Utopia. We'll talk about that after this bit of music. Listen to me, like Steve Wright. That track was, Russell?
That was the Scissor Sisters, I Can't Decide.
And why are we playing that?
Because the Master danced along to that.
Yeah, and we've just listened to, before that, Derek Jacobi as the Master, just before he became John Sim. Yeah. In case you're confused by what we're talking about, you're listening to Who on Who? With me, David Tennant, and Russell T. Davis. That's the title. It's Who on Who? Question mark.
That's clever.
Do you see what they've done
because
there?
Because you're Doctor Who, yeah, and no one knows, yeah, who I am.
I don't quite know how to say it though. I suppose I have to. Who on Who?
Who on Who?
Yeah.
Who on Who?
You're listening to Who on Who. So yeah, in that story Utopia, Russell, you brought back the Doctor's nemesis, the Master.
Mm-hmm. And he's back again this Christmas.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, it has been said that you once claimed you would never bring the Master back to Doctor Who.
Yes.
Did you do that categorically? Did you say that?
I probably did. It just depends what mood I was in that day. Yeah. Actually, he's the one I took longest. Maybe at the time I meant it because it took me a long time to work out how to do the Master. Mm. And also it took a couple of years on the programme to work out, you know, it was all new at the beginning. If we were in the first year of Doctor Who and we brought back the Daleks and that hadn't worked, I would have sat there going, right, let's never bring anything old back.
So when you said you weren't going to bring him back, you weren't necessarily lying at the time. You just
That's probably genuinely how I felt at that point.
You have always been quite happy to obfuscate
absolutely
to the press and the outside world about what may or may not happen.
It's part of this game we're in, isn't it? Of like, you know,
did that take you by surprise how big a part of the job that was and how difficult, I suppose, the amount of attention it got? Did that take everyone a bit by surprise?
I suppose, yes. Well, I mean, as a symptom of success, the success took us by surprise. And it's sort of inevitable. Once you're successful, everything else comes with it. I think I was very, very lucky in that I'd been through Queer as Folk, which is a drama I did for Channel 4, I was sitting in these very same studios talking endlessly to every radio station in the country about that. Actually, that part you were making earlier about how horribly visible I am. You were kind enough to leave out the word horribly. But that started with Queer as Folk because that had so many issues and proper political debates inherent in it. You couldn't leave the cast to debate that. It wasn't up to the actors to talk about the age of consent. And, you know, they weren't expert in those subjects and there was no need for them to be. So it was one of those shows where I had to step up to the plate and go up to the microphone and say what I think, and I've never left. I won't leave. Keep this microphone with me at all times.
But how hard have you found that kind of evolving relationship with the press, or have you enjoyed that game?
It's like playing with a tiger, isn't it? It's dangerous it's dangerous to relax, go, ha-ha, here we are in an interview and it's all going to be easy. One wrong thing and suddenly, I don't care what happens to me, but if the papers take against you and Doctor Who gets branded as soiled or dirty or wrong in some way. I remember when the whole Russell Brand and Jonathan Ross thing was kicking off and it was at the same time, that sort of round about the same time that Matt Smith was being announced, I think. And there were like 57 people dying to make jokes on the production team in interviews about, oh, well, why don't you cast Russell Brand as the new Doctor? Yeah. And actually, we put up really clear borders saying, don't make that joke because don't even associate Doctor Who with that world of trouble. You know, never mind that World of Trouble, whether it should have been trouble or not. That's a whole different debate. But, like, don't even take it into that area, because Russell Brand is the new Doctor, will become a headline everywhere. And you just want to keep the show clean for kids, you know? It's like, don't get dragged into it.
Do you think, how much do you think the last 5 years has taught you about that game and about how dangerous it is and how... Because it is, it's a dance, isn't it? With that, with the you know, and the press can be our greatest supporters. They can also be...
Oh, absolutely. We're guilty of using them, you know? It's like releasing photos, you know, just saying he will knock four times.
Yeah.
Just releasing that as a phrase and trying to make it sort of viral and having people pick up on it, that sort of thing, is a great part of the game. It is a dance, but it's simply dangerous if you think you've got the dance sussed.
Do you think you've got better at it as a result of...
I suppose. I mean, do you? How do you feel about that?
I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? I mean, it's the thing of wanting to be in the public eye and yet at the same time holding back secrets so that the drama works.
Yes, absolutely.
And there's a trade-off there, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's certainly been fun when we've managed to surprise people with something on screen.
Oh, that's been brilliant.
Monstrously difficult to do that, actually. Yes. And a couple of times we've pulled it off.
Once, really, wasn't it? Well, twice. Catherine Tate appearing at the end of The Runaway Bride and then your secret regeneration at the end of The Stolen. That was amazing when we got away with something which wasn't in the public eye. It was the cliffhanger where you regenerated, appeared to regenerate.
Yes.
And we ended up on the news.
That one took us by surprise. Yeah. We hadn't anticipated how big a story that was. I think.
That's true.
Yes. We just thought it was a funny, fun
cliffhanger.
Cliffhanger.
Because obviously you weren't changing.
Because obviously I wasn't changing because we'd have announced it and all that, or somebody would have found out.
Yeah.
But people ran with it and it became, it was on the Today programme.
I know. I remember watching it on Transmission, watching the end of The Stolen Earth on Transmission, and only, having seen the episode 57 times, only on Transmission did I sit there and go, oh my word, that's massive. And that's what the game plays up. Literally, we went up by 1.5 million viewers the next week, 2 million viewers. And that's what you want. It's made to be watched.
Was there a moment in 2005 when you thought, oh, we've got this right?
Oh, that's hard to think. No, because you know what it's like on Transmission every week. What's it like? Every Sunday morning.
Yeah.
What's the figures? What's the figures? You never relax. And I think actually that's been the key to keeping it great. Because, you know, the most frightening thing that happened was like a big one-off success at the beginning, because then you think, oh, we've got to sustain this. That's harder than doing it once. And it's my greatest delight that every year the viewing figures have gone up. Every single year. Every finale has had bigger viewing figures. But...
Oh, will we pull it off this year, though?
I don't know. Maybe just three people and a dog will be watching now.
But we'll be gone at one match.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Well,
I'm wrong. Life in the TARDIS.
You don't want me.
I'm not saying that.
But you asked me.
Would you rather be on your own?
No. Actually, no. But... the last time with Martha, like I said, it got complicated. And that was all my fault. I just want a mate.
You just want to mate?
I just want a mate.
You're not mating with me, Sunshine.
A mate. I want a mate.
Well, just as well, because I'm not having any of that nonsense. I mean, you're just a long streak of nothing, you know, alien nothing.
There we are, then.
Catherine Tate there as Donna Noble. Still making us laugh, that bit.
Yes, we were terrible. We laughed at our own material
I remember when she did that in the read-through, though, the room erupted.
Yeah, a long streak of ... nothing.
Yeah.
Polite.
You just want to mate.
You shot that scene twice, do you remember?
We did shoot that scene twice.
Yeah, the very first time you shot it, you were surrounded by nightclubs and drunk people.
And drunk people got, oi! Oi, doctor! Lots of that.
Good old Cardiff.
Yeah. Yeah, they're probably getting a Welsh accent. Yes. Before that, we had Love Don't Roam from The Runaway Bride, which was Catherine's first...
Of course. Her wedding song, yes. Dancing at the reception.
Written and sung by Neil Hannon of The Divine Comedy.
Written by Murray Gold.
I was thrilled Neil Hannon recorded songs for us.
Isn't that exciting?
Oh, very exciting. Obviously, Catherine brought so much to the show, didn't she? But she knows how to turn a funny line.
Oh, she does. But it's not just that, is it? She was heartbreaking, Donna.
Oh, no. I mean, that's she can do everything, Catherine, can't she?
Yeah, that's true. Just,
but was it, were you very attracted to the idea of... comedy's a big part of your writing, isn't it?
Mm, yes.
And is that something that is integral to Doctor Who, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I think it's the great quality that a lot of other science fiction shows don't have.
Yeah.
And I think you should celebrate your unique qualities. It's one of those things we call a unique selling point these days, and that's absolutely true of the wit in Doctor Who. It's what I used to love as a kid. It's when Tom Baker was funny. It's also how I've written. I think it's why I fit Doctor Who very well. It's just I will put a gag into the most serious situation. I'll do that in life. So, and I get into trouble for it an awful lot. So I do it in my set too. You've seen me do it. And I'll do it in scripts as well. I think it's human nature. I think actually it's like in the most serious situation, people do say funny things.
Yeah. What stories work best?
Oh, in Doctor Who?
Yeah.
Oh, well, all of, you know, it's that infinite format. You know, The Base Under Siege is a classic. That's like The Waters of Mars that we showed recently, where people are trapped in one place. That's a classic Doctor Who format. It's not just Doctor Who, it's unity of time and place, like a lot of good dramas. That's why I've stayed so long, because there's no one answer to that question. You can literally do anything. You sit and think of an idea like Midnight, where you're trapped in a room with Leslie Sharp and she's repeating everything you say, and just staying there for 45 minutes, you know, infinitely flexible. Brilliant.
So are you a little jealous of Stephen Moffat, who's now got all those toys to play with?
I'm not jealous. I'm really sort of, I'm happy because he's the most brilliant writer, and I know how much freedom he'll have and how much you can start to fly and how much unexplored territory there is. It's like when we did Voyager the Damned, which was the one on board the Titanic in space with Kylie Minogue. Weirdly, that was like the first time Doctor Who had ever done a disaster movie. After all those years, after decades, that was like a brand new idea for Doctor Who to do the Poseidon Adventure, because it's often stealing from old horror films and old formats and you know, and stealing from rom-coms and things like The Runaway Bride was a romantic comedy chase, the whole thing. So I just think, and Stephen's got the most fertile, brilliant mind, so the way he will go exploring, I just think he'll love it. He will absolutely love it and embrace it and go mental with it. So exciting times.
Time for another clip.
Planet Earth. This is where I was born. And this is where I died. For the first 19 years of my life, nothing happened. Nothing at all. Not ever. And then I met a man called the Doctor.
Run!
A man who could change his face. And he took me away from home in his magical machine. I thought it would never end.
How long are you going to stay with me?
Forever. That's what I thought. But then came the army of ghosts. Then came Torchwood and the war. And that's when it all ended. This is a story of how I died.
Billy Piper there. Oh. Reducing a nation to tears.
Wonderful, Billy. And the music of Murray Gold, it's so musical, isn't it? The whole thing is...
Oh. Rose didn't die, of course.
No.
But it did generate headlines. It got people talking, that storyline, didn't it? Which is something Doctor Who seemed to manage to do over the last few years. How do you think Saturday night television has been changed by what you've done?
Well, much as I'd love to single-handedly take the credit, in fact I will, it was all me. But it's funny because the changes to Saturday nights were already happening before Doctor Who came along, because
Felt like a big gamble at the time.
It was a
big
gamble.
I wasn't involved. I was watching it objectively and thinking, is this really going to work?
We were making Casanova, It was for drama, and I think that's if you put up barriers in your head between drama and entertainment and comedy and things like that. But actually, it was happening with stuff like Pop Idol. That was one of the big ethos I brought into Doctor Who, because I knew that me and my mates all gathered en masse to watch a Pop Idol final on a Saturday night, which is pure drama. When it's Gareth Gates or Will Young, that Pop Idol final, my God, there were like 20 of us in one house all phoning, all leaping up in the air when Will Young, and he still doesn't phone me or love me. Oh, right, that's a phone-in vote show. But it was drama. You were just sitting there. And I knew that audience could carry over into something like Doctor Who. And all that live, colourful, noisy energy of things like Pop Idol dragged into Doctor Who. We listened to that clip saying how musical that is. And actually, if you watch an hour of The X Factor, the music doesn't stop. I don't just mean on stage when they're singing. I mean the introductions, the little video clips, the promos of them, John and Edward in their house and all that sort of stuff. It's music, music, music all the time. So that's a big part of the format that I wanted to bring into Doctor Who, was the noise and the colour and the look at me-ness, the absolutely blunt, noisy look at me.
you brought a very definitive vision to it, didn't you? You were, in America, they call it a showrunner.
Yes.
We've started to use that term here now. But back in 2005, I guess maybe Paul Abbott was the showrunner in Shameless, maybe. And I guess the soaps have showrunners. But I mean, it wasn't something particularly known about in television culture here, was it?
No, I mean,
maybe
writers,
you should explain what that is.
Yeah, instead of just writing the scripts, it means that the writer is also a producer on it, normally an executive producer. So you're overseeing every aspect of production. Mm. So, you know, when you set something in the year 5 billion, you don't just hand a script in and disappear, because what the hell does that mean in the year 5 billion? Is everything silver? Is it gold? Is it dark? Is it a recession? Is it glitzy? Is it funny? Is it, you know, so what happens is we all sit around a table. We have these things called tone meetings that every design department and every technical department all sit around a table. We literally go through every page of the script. And I sort of, I always describe my job as transmitting, just transmitting all that. And I bore people to death because I just repeat myself and repeat myself and repeat myself about what the tone of it is. When you're talking about your first episode in The Christmas Invasion, it was like these enemy came along like the Sycorax, and the word for that was voodoo. They were voodoo monsters, so they looked like bone, they had bone, but they were tribal, they had a sort of exotic language. So that bleeds into the colours of the design. They didn't live inside a metal spaceship, it was rock. They weren't silver space costumes, they were robes, and that approaches who you cast. Sean Gilder was the leader of the Sycorax.
Yeah.
He's from Shameless.
Yes.
And he was absolutely brilliant. And so every aspect of the show is coordinated with massive input. Sometimes I describe this job and make myself sound like a dictator. And actually, I hope I'm sitting there listening to the brilliant people. You've got Louise in charge of costume, Babs on makeup, Ed on design, Neil on prosthetics, the Mill on the CGI. You're daft employing those people if you don't listen to them. But it's coordination. It's getting
everything.
But the
bug stops with you. If something's not working, you have to go away and make it right. You have to rewrite the script or find the person who needs to make it right.
I suppose, yes. I'm very quick to blame other people.
Oh, good. Yes.
Oh, my finger can point faster than a laser.
Sure.
But the good thing about this coordinated system is that there very rarely is blame. Things very rarely go wrong in that sense. You're always short of money and you're short of time. So there's always compromise. But that's right and fair on a team-led show. But you know, I don't think 60 episodes, I'm looking at it thinking, can't see where it really went wrong.
Yeah.
To be honest. Gosh, wow. That makes me sound terrible.
No, it's good. It's good. And is that why you've gone to America? Because you've done Britain?
I suppose, yes. I've been exiled and thrown out. But that's partly because actually there's no other job to match Doctor Who in this country. And I feel I've learned so much about publicity and marketing, the business side of television as well, that there's nowhere else to apply that except in America. And also, they've got so much more to teach us. That's the real point of going, is to learn. Not that I think their systems are marvellous and completely brilliant. I'm very quick to realise that out there, that it's as made up and as improvised and as screaming mad panic as anywhere else. But there are ways of learning things and ways of learning how not to do things out there. So it's good to go and be just a small fish in a big ocean out there, because you can just soak it all up and it's fascinating.
Alex in Manhattan, that was Yamit Mamo with My Angel Put the Devil in Me, which Miranda Hart mimed to very convincingly. But she didn't really sing it. You're listening to Who on Who with me, David Tennant, and Russell T Davis here on BBC Radio 2.
My bad, bad angel, you put the devil in me.
Obviously, Hollywood is the home of lots of television. You're on record as saying you love television, that it's sort of it's kind of in your DNA. Do you love films in the same way?
I do. Well, I'm not a film buff at all like that. I'm really coarse in my taste and wouldn't go to see what I still call an art house film or something like that. I'm afraid my poor boyfriend cannot get me to see anything with subtitles in, which is really ignorant, isn't it? I'm just...
You told me to see Let the Right One In.
Ah, but that's got vampires.
Oh, I see.
And great death in it, and an assault at a swimming pool. Yeah. It's brilliant. That's my running joke at home, is if it's got a monster and a spaceship and an explosion, then I'm very happy watching it. I go for spectacle. I actually do go to the cinema for spectacle.
Right.
Oh, I'm coarse. I'm just coarse.
How has your writing changed by working on Doctor Who?
That's hard to know. I tell you why that's hard to know, because you learn things.
You probably can't tell.
No, exactly. Except no one thinks about my writing more than I do. So I do think about it all the time. I think about the problem is, and there must be brilliant things coming from it, I hope, but the problem is you learn things on Doctor Who that don't apply to anything else. Sometimes a science fiction drama, there's something strangely radio drama-like about it, in that someone will pick up a gun and point it at someone. And the more I work on these scripts, the more I realise that actually they still need a line saying, I'm going to kill you, which is weird. Drama's normally the opposite. It's like, you know, you can see someone pointing a gun, you don't need the line. Take the line out saying, I'm going to kill you. There's something about science fiction, because it's unreal, because everything in it is unreal, but demands that you add more lines.
Serve it up.
Yes, it would explain clearly what's going on. It's quite odd that, because my natural writing style doesn't explain what's going on. I will not have characters sit down explaining why they're doing things. And in science fiction, you have to do that because they're not doing real things. They're doing artificial things with lasers and reality bombs and things like that. So I just don't know. Maybe I never will. I don't know.
Well, that's probably best. I mean, you don't want to be too...
No.
...full of self-examination. Here's another clip.
Ah, you'll have quite a bit of this. Atmospheric disturbance. Still a little part.
Oh, a doctor. What about you now? Who've you got? I mean, all those friends of yours.
They've all got someone else. Still, that's fine. I'm fine.
I'll watch out for you, sir.
You can't ever tell her.
No, no. But every night, doctor, when it gets dark and the stars come out, I'll look up. On her behalf, I'll look up at the sky and think of you.
Thank you.
That's Me in the Rain with Bernard Cribbins.
Sir Bernard Cribbins.
Yeah.
Why not? The campaign starts here.
What a magnificent actor. We've had a lot of magnificent actors, though, over the years, haven't we?
Very lucky.
And from every sort of range of the acting world.
Yeah, your posh theatre.
Derek Jacobi's, and your Working Man's Club, Peter Kay's.
Absolutely. A new talent as well, you know, Russell Tovey, Lenora Critchlow.
Yes.
All those people in there. Yeah. That's been one of the best things, I think.
Kerry Mulligan, who apparently is going to win an Oscar now.
She's not doing badly. Yeah. All down to Blink.
Oh, exactly. She owes us everything. how important do you think it's been to have big names, big actors in the series?
It does no harm. It's brilliant. I mean, people become big name actors because they're brilliant, actually. It's a very merit-driven industry, and if your name's out there, then you're good, Frank. I really believe that. Everyone has their favourites. Everyone has famous people they don't like. But actually, everyone's got something going for them if you've made it that well. And they bring an audience. You know, I genuinely believe it increases your audience. I think, you know, if you put Penelope Wilton into something and she greased us three times with her presence, then I think you get perhaps a theatre-going audience or a sort of BBC Four-type audience that will come and watch Penelope being in something. And at the same time, you get eight-year-old kids discovering what a brilliant actress this woman is. I love that. So it increases the whole range of the programme. So on a ruthless level, it gets a bit of publicity every week, which is nice.
Yeah.
You know, obviously you cast Kylie and you'll be publicised to death.
Yes, that helped.
But you wouldn't cast her if she couldn't act, and I knew she could act. I used to watch Neighbours all the time. I thought she was wonderful and she was brilliant. So it's a nice, it's part of that public game again. Look who's in it this week.
Yeah.
It's fun.
So are you pleased?
Yes. Are you?
With it?
I am. Enormous. Please doesn't cover it. I mean, you don't stop and assess it, really, and maybe you never do. I remember this happened during Queer as Folk. People said, you know, which was a big success.
Well, when you look back on Queer as Folk now, how do you feel about it?
I don't. You see, at the time, I would have said, well, once it's all over, I'll look back and I'll really be pleased at what I've done. And it's 10 years later and I've never really gone and done that. But I love it when it crops up, but you just move on to the next thing.
But Queer as Folk probably changed your life.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
And Doctor Who has probably changed your life.
Yes. But but your life just carries on, doesn't it?
Well, it's just an ongoing, you're there in it every day, I suppose. So it's an ongoing story for you.
Yeah. And there's opportunities you get. And unashamedly, doors open within the industry because of those successes, which is, you know, good for me and annoying for other people who don't get that. But it is different with Doctor Who because it was always my favourite show. And to see it being number one all the time, to see it, you know, and just number one at the top of people's conversations, you know, you can say to anyone in this country, I think I work on Doctor Who, and they'll know what you mean.
Yeah.
And that's brilliant. You and I have worked on a million shows, and that's not true of any other show, actually.
No, it's completely unique, the kind of reach it has, and the kind of cross-cultural, generational appeal that it has.
And that is lovely, especially when I always loved it. I always thought everyone should love it. Yeah. And it was amazing to me that other people didn't. And now you see it sort of fully restored and lionised. I love that. I think it absolutely deserves it.
Well, the final one goes out in a couple of days.
Yes.
I'm very proud of it.
Our final one.
Our final
one.
Yes,
on.
Yes, sorry.
It carries on.
Was that a little self-centred there? Apparently it carries on without us.
Yes, I won't be watching. No.
But then it's you know, it seemed to do all right from 1963 to when we showed up.
That Merlin's rather good. I think I'll get into that.
Yes. Well, you know, there's other things.
We will be watching like good, faithful fanboys.
I can't wait.
I know. Can you imagine? We won't know what happens.
Yeah.
Wow.
Listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you now. It's been a pleasure working with you for the last 5 years.
Stop it, shut up. We can't begin to say the same amount in return.
Well, it's. I'm glad we got to do this today. I hope we haven't bored everyone to death.
Who on who?
Who on who?
Who?
Russell T. Davis, thank you for being here.
David, thank you.